At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Here with an economic truism. Nobody does win a trade war, but tariffs? Oh yeah, we got some winners there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday, the 3rd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have been talking quite a bit on this program lately about President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs. Countries and companies that have asked for exemptions for the sake of their domestic industries or for their corporate bottom lines. We're going to be hearing a bit more from that side of the economic equation on this in a minute. But before we do get there, a moment for the pro-tariff crowd. Because remember, the whole idea behind these things is to help out this country's steel and aluminum industries. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath takes a look at some of the aluminum tariff winners.
Smelting. Besides being a really fun word to say, what is that exactly? Heidi Brock is CEO of the Aluminum Association. She should know.
Do you know where the word smelt comes from? Smelting?
I'm afraid I can't help you with that one. It's a good question, though. We can research that for you.
Probably figure that out.
Turns out it comes from the Middle German schmelten, to smelt, which just means to melt. There is more to it, though. There are 6 working smelters in the U.S. They zap alumina with electricity to make raw, what's called first-use aluminum. These huge blocks of it, ingots.
Something that's the size of a pickup truck.
That's what gets rolled and extruded and sold to other companies, which turn it into tinfoil and beer cans. But it's the smelters, those 6 plants making the raw aluminum ingots, that would theoretically benefit from taxes on the foreign stuff. Monica DeBolle of the Peterson Institute breaks it down. If aluminum imports become more expensive, domestic smelters can raise prices too. They couldn't compete before.
But now, because everybody's prices are going up, they gain because they can now face off with these other producers who before were able to sell the same stuff for less, but now they can't because they face tariffs.
That's the classic case for protectionism. But here come the ifs and buts and asterisks. Because those smelters represent 3% of the domestic aluminum sector. And the other 97% is going to have to pay more for that raw aluminum. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
So the winners, as Ryan pointed out, see the tariffs as a way to boost their bottom lines. But there is no small number of American companies who see the tariffs as a direct threat to their bottom lines. As of the last count, the Department of Commerce has gotten more than 7,000 exemption requests, and we've been digging through some of them the past week or 10 days or so. Of the many common threads we have found, by far the most common is that these companies simply can't buy what they need here. Stephen Katz is a plant manager at United Chemicons facility in Lansing, North Carolina. They make aluminum electrolytic capacitors.
It should be a no-brainer. We have no supplier that can produce in the U.S. for what we buy. We should not have been included to start with, but understand how the system works, but it is frustrating.
Ronnie Smith is vice president of operations at McMahon Steel Supply in Houston. Oilfield steel bars and tubing is their stock and trade. Mr. Smith is also a student of steel history.
I've been to most of the world's steel mills, and I don't think people really understand that the U.S. never, you know, since World War II, actually, or the end of World War II, reinvested in its steelmaking ability.
And so today, Mr. Smith says foreign steel is far, far ahead.
They're using robotics and new techniques that the steel industry doesn't employ that many people. And if they were to build new steel mills now, it'd be mostly roboticized processes. It wouldn't be a huge employment boom for anybody.
And global trade, Mr. Smith knows, is a complicated beast.
You know, we really are not sure whether we have any chance to make an impact on the process at all. We're just basically at the whims of EU negotiations and negotiations with Japan over military bases, things like that. And if the administration gets what it wants, then maybe they'll let up on the trade tariffs and quotas. But we do definitely feel caught in between.
Regulations.gov is where you can read some of those exemption requests for yourself. Also here, a reminder, the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is in Beijing as we speak, talking trade with the Chinese. All right, now a lesson in hubris CEO style. Tesla had its earnings call with analysts yesterday, a chance for those analysts to ask questions of top company officials, and those top company officials most of the time, a chance for them to give those analysts the corporate line. Not so, though, Tesla and CEO Elon Musk. Here is just a snippet of the company's call yesterday.
And so where specifically will you be in terms of capital requirement?
Next. Boring bonehead questions are not cool. Next.
Bonehead questions are not cool. Next. Bad quality tape there, but that's what he said. Here's another one, minus the actual question, which, as it happens, was about the car. Musk has staked basically the entire company on the Tesla Model 3.
These questions are so dry. They're killing me.
Questions are so dry, they're killing me, he said. The funny thing is, Tesla's earnings were better than analysts expected. The challenge for the company now, though, is to make the turn from those pricey models S and X to the mass market 3. And as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports, a whole lot of things need to go right for him.
Musk says Tesla will be a year late on its promise to deliver 5,000 Model 3s per week. And the company posted a record loss last quarter, burning through nearly $1 billion in cash. The spending and delays are troubling to some investors. But Auto Pacific analyst Ed Kim says,
I'm actually in some ways kind of surprised that they're as far along as they are. Going from being a niche automaker and scaling that all the way up to Model 3 levels, which is a much more mainstream high-volume car, would be a challenge for anybody.
So right now, Tesla has more than 450,000 customers still waiting for their Model 3s. It's paying 40,000 employees and building a huge battery factory. Gartner analyst Mike Ramsey says Wall Street has serious questions about Tesla's cash flow.
Just the sheer size of their capital investments make it more dangerous for them to have these big production slows down, even though they have clear demand for the product.
Musk has acknowledged Tesla's highly automated factories are partly to blame for delays.
Detroit automakers learned a long time ago that not every job is cut out for automation, that you need a human.
Auto Trader analyst Michelle Krebs says Tesla has more to learn from the auto industry it's disrupting, but
when we read the history books, we will look back on Elon Musk and Tesla as turning the tide in terms of more electric vehicles.
Gartner's Mike Ramsey says the company's ambitions are so far keeping it afloat.
Tesla, if this was just a normal company, they'd be out of business already. But they're not a normal company.
For Musk, normal was never the goal. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
If you happen to have checked on the markets at, say, noonish and not since, I'm pleased to be able to tell you it is not as bad as it was. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a narrative out there about 20 and 30-somethings who are thinking about buying a house, and it goes something like this. Forget it. Prices are rising, interest rates are going up. Even if you can scrape together a down payment, you'll never qualify for a mortgage. Or maybe you've heard this version, that millennials aren't buying houses because they don't want them. They're still traumatized from seeing what happened to everybody else during the financial crisis. And yet, poll after poll, including our own Marketplace Edison research poll, shows home ownership is as big a goal for young people as it is for everybody else. And narratives aside, young people actually do manage to buy houses. So instead of another story on why it's so hard, we sent Marketplace's Rima Krace out to talk to some younger home buyers about how they made it happen.
After years of renting in Los Angeles, 32-year-old Laura Redke and her husband Philip finally found it, their new home.
We bought the ugliest house on the block.
Dirty peach stucco, rotting wood, burnt out front yard. Not exactly what they'd imagined for themselves and their new baby.
I remember when we came here, looking around, trying to keep an open mind.
About things like mold in the kitchen, a shower that had been used as a giant litter box, and that hole in the floor big enough to fall through. Now, a year and $25,000 later, the inside is almost unrecognizable. Almost.
There's still a random hole in the ceiling.
And the Red Keys, not quite a dream house, cost more than $500,000. That's not surprising for a two-bed, two-bath in a market like L.A. For Laura, an environmental scientist who grew up in Hawaii, it's about stability.
From age 8 on, we always rented. It's all I've known.
It was always more of Laura's thing to try to get a house, and because for me it just seemed, unattainable.
Buying a house is more unattainable these days, especially a first house. The home ownership rate among millennials is the lowest in 50 years. One of the biggest hurdles? A down payment. Laura and Philip had money saved. They also had some stock. But for lots of first-time buyers, it's meet the parents.
The majority of young buyers that we're working with do have help from family members.
Imran Ali is a real estate agent in Los Angeles, which is a lot like being a therapist these days. He says houses get multiple offers the minute they hit the market. And waiting to find out if theirs is the winner makes his clients, well...
I get text messages sometimes at 11:30 at night. And I'm very sensitive to their situation, but I also have a 14-month-old, so I need to sleep. I need my rest.
Sometimes he needs it so he can deliver the bad news that his clients didn't get the house. And when that happens, Ali unleashes the poetry. Rudyard Kipling's If.
If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve you long after they are gone and to hold on when there is nothing in you except the will that says to you, hold on, that's kind of what I tell buyers.
29-year-old Mark Erickson and his wife Rachel didn't have the words of an English poet to guide them when they were looking for a house in Tennessee, but they had something else.
We had at least 2 to 3 other family members combing a Zillow, looking at any other sites they had access to. It felt like Tinder.
Bad Tinder, where you get your hopes up only to be disappointed. Then, after weeks of searching, Mark and Rachel made an offer for a $200,000 house, and they got it. Great, right?
I felt nauseous. I just felt terrible.
I was feeling panicked, I think.
It's so much money. It's so, like, as a medical student, I'm already in so much incredible amount of debt.
And it all happened so fast. 33-year-old Jeffrey Spivey has a name for making the biggest investment decision of your young life in a split second. Shotgun home buying. That's what he and his husband did recently when they relocated to Arkansas and had just a few days to find a new place.
Like the house that we actually chose, my husband was like, oh, like, you know, like we like this house. We want to go back and see it. And I was like, what does it look like? I don't remember anything about it.
He didn't have much time to grasp the process either.
I didn't understand like escrow and like why it's important and feel like I only like halfway understand now, but.
But he pulled it off.
This definitely signifies the biggest part of adulthood.
And Spivey didn't waste any time letting the world know. Once the deal was done, he posted a picture on social media with his husband, a big red sold sign, and a caption reading, I'm a grown-up now. In Los Angeles, I'm Rena Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We're open arms and we're ready to accommodate whatever they need.
Amazon can be yours for a price, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials had another 400-point swing today. In the end, the index up less than a 10%, 5 points, closed at 23,930. The NASDAQ dipped about a 10%, 12 points, finished at 7,088. The S&P 500 gave back 0.2%. That's 5 points, ended at 26.29. Told you about Elon Musk and his behavior, I guess, sent Tesla shares into a timeout. They reversed more than 5%. Disappointing earnings did a number on insurer AIG. Shares erased 5%. Cardinal Health was in even worse shape. Makes money off generic drugs, that company does. When their prices drop, stock gets hurt. It fell 22.0% today. Bonds pretty much steady. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of the defining characteristics of this economy in the decade since the financial crisis has been the uneven way that it's recovered. Our project covering the 10 years we have all just lived through is called Divided Decade. Today, a look at geography. How, generally speaking, the coasts have bounced back and big chunks of the middle of the country are still stuck. Columnist Sarah Kendzior lives in that middle, St. Louis, Missouri, from whence she's been writing about what she sees. Her collection of essays is called The View from Flyover Country. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to jump to the end of this book in which you talk about, I guess it's the irony, but I think it's more than that, of the people and the economy and the situation that you wrote about in the middle of this country in 2012 and 2013 becoming now, five-ish years later, sort of the center of the conversation. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm looking forward to this book going out of date because, you know, what I describe is systemic inequality, a lot of suffering among citizens, you know, and not just here, but nationwide. And unfortunately, these are systemic problems that weren't dealt with well under the Obama administration and certainly aren't being dealt with well under the Trump administration.
Not dealt with, we should also say, just in the spirit of, you know, the stretch of history, in many previous administrations as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, these problems that I describe of, you know, people having an inability to get by, to pursue opportunities, you know, they date back decades. And in terms of economic restructuring, really began in the late 70s, early 80s under Reagan and, you know, under this kind of abandonment, I think, of, you know, middle class and working class Americans and opportunity hoarding instead by elites.
Let me get you to your subtitle for a second, Dispatches from the Forgotten America. Do you mean actively forgotten or malignantly neglected?
I mean malignantly neglected. You know, neglected is a much better term to use because that puts accountability on those who have failed, you know, the majority of American citizens. And that, unfortunately, is a tendency that we see, as you said, going back multiple decades.
As we sit here, I think we're now officially in the second longest peacetime economic expansion in history. Tell me what it looks like and feels like from where you sit.
I mean, that to me, you know, sounds like a joke. I mean, I guess, you know, maybe you're talking globally. You know, globally, there has been a reduction, you know, of the worst kind of poverty. Within the United States, you know, I don't think that's the case. Like where I'm sitting right now in St. Louis is near neighborhoods where people have the same life expectancy as those in Yemen or Iraq or Syria, you know, areas that have of the world that have experienced war. And people look at North St. Louis and they ask, you know, what happened here? And what happened is abandonment. It's apathy towards the suffering of the people who live there. The reason for that, I mean, there's a lot of it, but it's largely racism. And so, you know, that's something that certainly St. Louis hasn't been willing to confront. And you see it in these, you know, Midwestern and Southern cities where a good part of the population has been, you know, systemically locked out of the economy for a very long period of time.
Turn the page to the economic for me for a minute and give me some sense of how you would see the economic lot of people in North St. Louis or in your neighborhood or anywhere in that great stretch of this country that you and your title call flyover country, how they would be made better off.
I mean, it's not a monolith. Everybody is struggling with different problems. But I think as people get older, you know, and they want to maybe break out, they want to enter a certain industry, there are all these prohibitive forces that are preventing them from doing so. The cost of higher education, the reliance on unpaid labor, on unpaid internships as a way to basically marginalize and keep out talented people who have something to contribute to various industries. I think most adults really, you know, don't have much experience in what I would claim to be a functional economy. That's the dream that the baby boomers had. That's a lifestyle they had that they tell us about that sounds like a fairy tale.
Your last couple of paragraphs in this book, I won't call them optimistic, but they're not grim, if that makes any sense.
As opposed to the rest of the book, yeah.
Well, yeah. I wonder how you ended in that not grim place as after, you know, a couple hundred pages of you know, anger.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I don't like to think of things in terms of hope or of hopelessness. I just look pragmatically at the situation. And I think that people in the U.S. Have woken up to these problems. And I think that people will continue to pursue that objective, whether those in power want it or not. It's very unfortunate that it takes a crisis or multiple crises to kind of bring this wake-up call about. But in that sense, I'm still glad that it occurred.
Sarah Kendzior, she writes for the Globe and Mail. She has written for a bunch of other places and has compiled some columns from 5-6 years ago now in a book called The View from Flyover Country. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
We were talking a little bit yesterday about Amazon and the 218 non-finalists in the sweepstakes that that company's running to find a city in which to build its second headquarters. One of the 20 lucky finalists is going to add 50,000 jobs, Amazon promises, and get more than $5 billion in new local investment. But that bounty does not come free. Part of any winning package is going to include financial incentives the company is going to get from the city in question. Two cities in Texas are on the list of finalists, Austin and Dallas. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, Texas does have some economic experience with landing these big marquee companies.
Back in 2014, Toyota was planning to relocate its North American headquarters from Torrance, California. And Toyota's Chris Nielsen, now an executive VP, says the company wanted thousands of employees to move with it, a hard sell coming from a picturesque oceanfront town.
Really, the most important considerations, quality of life for team members, economic factors for the company.
And Toyota chose Plano, Texas, a middle-class suburb of Dallas. Housing's affordable, the schools are good, and state and local government offered in excess of $50 million in financial incentives and tax abatements to seal the deal.
It's certainly not the most important factor, but we would look more favorably at those looking to invest in us just as we're making a significant investment in them.
That investment in Plano, it's now upwards of $1 billion. Toyota's new Plano campus has coffee bars, fitness centers, and a training facility where I strapped on a virtual reality visor to visit a Toyota assembly plant.
The 8,000 team members who work here are trained to the highest standards in the industry.
Plano Mayor Harry LaRosslière says the economic boost from Toyota more than offsets the cost of incentives.
It's going to mean over $7 billion, is with the B, to our community. So not only obviously sales tax revenue, but travel, retail, hotel.
Now, because of Toyota's temporary property tax abatement, Plano will receive less tax revenue to fund schools, though taxpayers statewide pick up some of those education costs. Government professor Nate Jensen at the University of Texas, Austin, says that's a problem.
I think tax abatements in general are a bad idea.
Because they starve government of tax revenues it'll need for schools, roads, police. So as Amazon is now kicking the tires in Austin and Dallas, among other cities, to locate its second headquarters, the question is, should those communities offer financial incentives? Jensen has concerns about the proposal submitted to Amazon.
We know almost nothing. Who was all at the table? Which land developers were brought in and which weren't? Were labor groups and environmental groups part of this discussion? The Chamber of Commerce submitted the bid, and they are not subject to public records requests.
Both the Austin and Dallas Chambers of Commerce told us they're under non-disclosure agreements, though Amazon said the bidders can release their proposals to the public. Dallas is pretty gung-ho about the value proposition of landing Amazon, but in Austin, many have their doubts.
I really think it's too big of an entity to come. We're not ready with the traffic infrastructure that our schools are ready for the new incomers.
That's Austin City Councilmember Leslie Poole. She doesn't want to spend any taxpayer money to lure Amazon to town. But Austin Chamber President Mike Rollins says some financial incentives would be worth it.
You know, early indications are that Amazon wants to be a partner in solving the community issues, whether it's mobility, whether it's affordability, whether it's housing.
And up in pro-growth Dallas, here's Jessica Hare at the Regional Chamber of Commerce.
We're open arms and we're ready to accommodate whatever they need.
So what should best practices be for cities and states trying to snag a company like Amazon? Clint Pinehart studies tax incentives and economic development at the University of Texas, Dallas.
Transparency, telling us the packages once they've been accepted.
Also monitoring company job creation and investment. And
clawbacks.
So that if a company gets money and doesn't do what it said it would, the government can take the money back. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, getting us back to where we started, tariffs and the winners and losers thereof. I mentioned Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the gang are over in Beijing talking about this stuff. Here is an item that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, but is clearly a move by the Chinese to concentrate the Americans' minds. Bloomberg reports that Beijing has basically stopped buying American soybeans. The CEO of a New York-based seed processor told Bloomberg, he said this, quote, "They are buying beans in Canada, in Brazil, mostly Brazil, but very deliberately not buying anything from the U.S., end of quote. Those negotiations that Mnuchin's running, they wrap up tomorrow, by the way. All right, here we go. After swinging through 400 points, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished up less than a 10% today. 5 points. NASDAQ dipped about a 10%, 12 points. S&P 500 gave back 0.2%. That is 5 points. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. Thanks today to the gang here at Stanford Video for hooking me up. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow back in L.A., everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.